The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
You're listening to UK Health Radio. Welcome to the Therapy Suite. I'm Duncan Ellison, a therapeutic counsellor with a focus on positive mental health. This week in the headlines, school records, crying, and exposure to bright light. We'll also find out the difference between FOMO and social anxiety. And in the Toolbox Talk this week, we'll take a look at what being sectioned really means. So if good mental health matters to you, then this show is not to be missed. Join me, Duncan Ellison, as we open the doors to the Therapy Suite, only on UK Health Radio. Mental health news making the headlines this week. Researchers are looking into school records for clues on suicide and self-harm. The project aims to identify risk factors by comparing school and health records, paving the way for early intervention. Following the publication of figures which reveal 98 suicides among 10 to 14-year-olds in the UK between 2005 and 2014. It's hoped the study will reveal trends as to whether a child is at risk of self-harm or suicide. Stats reveal that 1 in 10 young people have suicidal thoughts, and this is heightened during school transition and exam periods. The project is drawing data from Croydon, Lambeth, Lewisham and Southwark boroughs of London, which are covered by the South London and Maudsley NHS Foundation Trust. When put together, the researchers hope the data will help identify warning signs in school records that could lead to children and the schools being given targeted help in the future. According to Liam Hackett, founder and CEO of anti-bullying charity Ditch the Label, the majority of us have negative attitudes towards crying. The analysis of over 12 million online conversations found that the measurable lack of emotional openness we have within society is having clear and detrimental impacts upon our mental health, leading to surges in depression, anxiety, body dysmorphia, and eating disorders, amongst others. Liam comments, "The notion that it isn't okay to cry is a dangerous one. Our culture of stiff upper lip discourages the natural and healthy ways in which negative emotion must be processed. Whilst this is an issue that affects all of us, it is disproportionately more so in men, leading to an unemotional masculine culture." Liam believes acknowledging negative emotions and dealing with them through talking, crying and exercise is an important fact of life. Also in the news, daily exposure to bright white light at midday significantly decreased symptoms of depression and increased functioning in people with bipolar disorder, a recent study has found. 68% of study participants who were exposed to bright white light for 6 weeks between noon and 2:30 p.m. experienced a significantly higher remission rate from mild depression to return to normal functioning, compared to 22% of patients who received a placebo light. Previous studies found that morning bright light therapy reduced symptoms of depression in patients with seasonal affective disorder, but patients with bipolar experienced side effects. Finally, it's been revealed approximately one-fifth of patients with cancer went on to experience post-traumatic stress disorder several months after their diagnosis, with many patients continuing to live with PTSD years later. This information highlights the need for careful monitoring and early intervention. Although PTSD is primarily known to develop in individuals following a traumatic event, such as a serious accident or natural disaster, it can also occur in patients diagnosed with cancer. However, some say PTSD in cancer has not been explored thoroughly. Many cancer patients believe they need to adopt a warrior mentality and remain positive and optimistic from diagnosis through to treatment to stand a better chance of beating their cancer. And to these patients seeking help for emotional issues, could be seen to be admitting to weakness, said one doctor involved in researching the connections between cancer and PTSD. Clinicians say there needs to be a greater understanding that there is nothing wrong with getting help to manage the emotional upheaval of cancer. Looking back at the news this week, how do you feel about people skimming through your child's school records for clues on the potential of suicide and self-harm? Do you think this is a good thing or simply a waste of time? We heard that 1 in 10 young people have suicidal thoughts or thoughts of self-harm. So for an average junior school class of 30 pupils, and it is at this age that issues start, 10 to be precise, 3 children are at high risk. So researchers are aiming to try and identify trends which may provide a link to what causes such thoughts. The plan is also to spot what areas, and more specifically what schools, have the highest risks so early intervention can take place. Information will identify potentially stressful events for children, such as starting exams and changing schools, as well as absences and whether they have suffered bullying or abuse. The researchers will also have information on deprivation indicators at the schools, including the percentage of pupils receiving free school meals. The school records can be linked to information held by health services and hospitals, although the researchers will receive it as anonymous data which cannot be traced to individuals. When put together, the researchers hope the data will help identify warning signs in school records that could lead to children and their schools being given targeted help in the future. A spokesperson for the project said, "It offers new hope to thousands of young people and their families who are devastated by suicide and self-harm. Right now, too many children are left struggling with their mental health in silence without the help they desperately need." Moving on. There is a reason why you may not be a morning person, and I might have found a reasonable excuse to stay in bed a little bit longer if you're not feeling, well, overly enthusiastic. In all seriousness, as we heard in the news, exposure to early to mid-morning light is not conducive to people with certain mental illnesses. However, daily exposure to bright white light, specifically at midday, significantly decreased symptoms of depression and increase functionality in people with bipolar disorder. This is according to a recent study. Previous studies found that morning bright light therapy reduced symptoms of depression in patients with seasonal affective disorder, but patients with bipolar experienced side effects. You may remember in the first programme I touched on indoor light therapy, and this will give you the best that bright light can offer, whatever the time of day or season. So if you are looking for an illuminative pick-me-up, try saying that if you've only just got up in the morning. Here are 10 useful tips. Number 1, make sure your light box is 10,000 lux. If you don't know what that means, a quick look up on the internet will most certainly give you the answers. Don't use a normal lamp because you are trying to mimic the full spectrum of light found in sunlight. You need to use light boxes made for bright light therapy, or phototherapy as it's known. This means the light box should emit 10,000 lux, which is 20 times the strength of typical indoor lighting. If you have a lamp with fewer lux units, then you may need to use it for longer periods of time to achieve the same benefit. Your light box should provide the full spectrum of bright white light, but block ultraviolet rays. Also, the light box should filter out 99% of ultraviolet rays, which are harmful to your body. Now, I didn't know that. Number 3, you need to position the box at eye level or higher. The position and distance of your light box relative to your eyes really does make a difference. The light box should mimic being outside in sunlight. And whilst we're talking about positioning, you need to place the light box about 2 feet away from your eyes. Also, if you have a weaker light box, this means you will need to sit closer to it. So this is quite specific information. You need to keep the light box at an angle to the left or right, or about 2 o'clock or 10 o'clock as you're facing it. Number 6, use the light box in the morning for 20 to 60 minutes, depending on your individual needs. Start with 20 or 30 minutes of the light box every morning to see if that helps boost your mood and energy. If it isn't making a difference, then try longer periods, say for up to 60 minutes each morning. you certainly can multitask with Bright Light Therapy. You can have your morning coffee and breakfast, check your email, put on your makeup, you get the drift. Consistency is really important with this kind of therapy. And by that, we mean you need to use it throughout the seasons. So it's not just something that you use in the winter or maybe the spring or the autumn. You need to continue the therapy. Daily use is more likely to help boost your mood and energy. If you're only using the light box a few times a week, well, it stands to reason it's going to be less effective. Number 8, do not use light therapy if you're taking medications that are photosensitive. Photosensitive medications make your skin sensitive to light, leading to skin changes that can look like sunburn or a rash. Number 9, and this is really important, you need to monitor your mood. Well, just to check it's working for you. You should start to notice more energy and an improved mood within 1 to 2 weeks of daily use. Many people notice a more immediate response to light therapy. If you are looking to try bright light therapy, make sure you talk to your doctor first. Some people can have a bad reaction to the bright light in the first few days, such as suicidal thoughts or hypomania, a state marked by excess energy and a lack of sleep. And finally, number 10, combine light therapy with other effective approaches for seasonal depression, like CBT, for instance. One study found that 6 weeks of CBT twice a week was just as effective as daily bright light therapy for 30 minutes. Yoga, mindfulness, exercise, and more time outdoors during the daytime will certainly help as well. So there you go, 10 top bright light therapy tips for you to have a go with. So how do you feel about crying? According to Liam Hackett, founder and CEO of anti-bullying charity Ditch the Label, the majority of us have negative attitudes towards crying. He also makes the following recommendation. For 2018, he says, I'd like to propose 2 alternative challenges. To cry more and to detox your digital life. Actually, do you know what? I think he might well have hit the nail on the head. We've spoken probably on every programme since we launched in November about the contributing negative effect social media has on our mental well-being. It struck me last night when I was reading through the notes for this week's show that I have possibly encouraged a contradiction whereby social media is concerned. On one hand, I've said reduce your social media activity, yet when I suggest making contact with me, with your views, thoughts and ideas, I've encouraged you to contact me through Twitter. An interesting contradiction there. The analysis of over 12 million online conversations found that the measurable lack of emotional openness we have within society is having a clear and detrimental impact upon our mental health. And this leads to surges in depression, anxiety, body dysmorphia, and eating disorders, amongst others. Now, I think that's clear and we understand that. But what about crying? Here's a question for you. Are we crying more or less in the 21st century? Statistically, women cry between 30 and 64 times a year, compared to men who cry just 6 to 17 times. Scientifically, men have significantly less hormone that enables us to cry emotional tears. But when we do, there is still a stigma that society will judge us. Do you think men crying reduces their manliness? Research shows that 85% of women and 73% of men felt less sad and angry after crying. And that's good. Have you ever thought how long you actually cry for? Well, statistically, crying bouts last on average 6 minutes. And more tears are shed between 7 and 10pm than any other time of the day. And here's a few more stats as to why crying is actually healthy for us. First and foremost, it reduces stress. Crying lowers blood pressure. Tears remove toxins from the body. It reduces manganese, a mineral which affects mood, and is found 30 times more concentrated in tears than blood. And looking at basic functionality, emotional crying means that you are human. As a counsellor, and I talk from experience, it is unnerving the first time you sit with a client and they cry. And yes, in this case, gender doesn't discriminate. Men and women cry in the therapy room. Crying is not only a human response to sorrow and frustration. As we've heard, it's also a healthy one. Crying is a natural way to reduce emotional stress that, left unchecked, has a negative physical effect on the body, including increasing the risk of cardiovascular disease and other stress-related disorders. Liam comments, "The notion that it isn't okay to cry is a dangerous one. Our culture of stiff upper lip discourages the natural and healthy ways in which negative emotion must be processed. So come on, fellas, let's even those figures out. Crying is healthy, it's natural, and it has a cleansing action. There really should be no stigma." Finally, PTSD is once again back in the news. It's been revealed approximately one-fifth of patients with cancer went on to experience post-traumatic stress disorder several months after their diagnosis, with many patients continuing to live with PTSD years later. This information highlights the need for careful monitoring and early intervention. It seems that doctors are missing critical information about the feelings of cancer patients once they pass what is known as the acute phase, which may last upwards of 6 months. One doctor confessed, "Once the symptoms of cancer abate, we just presume everything is going well. We don't actually ask the question." And this can also have a very negative effect on the mindset of recovering patients. Another doctor involved in this much-needed research said, "In terms of the consequences of this and how it might affect cancer treatments, one of the cardinal symptoms of PTSD is avoidance. Patients who are experiencing PTSD may actually avoid having scans, going to oncology appointments, things that might remind them of the traumatic experience they've already been through." We heard in the news earlier that clinicians say there needs to be a greater understanding by patients that there is nothing wrong with getting help to manage the emotional upheaval of cancer. One cancer sufferer who had stage 3 testicular cancer revealed the rather dark reality of the treatment process, commenting that after what seemed to be a successful initial treatment, the oncologist had him undergo a scan that also involved painful catheterization. When the results were inconclusive, he said the doctor asked to repeat the procedure, to which he initially refused. He continued, "One of the most insidious things about cancer is when you realise the treatment is working and you're not going to die, but the treatment is so overwhelming that you don't care if you do." He continues, "It happens to a lot of people and it happened to me." Tough words to take in there, don't you think? Coming up in the programme, we'll be taking a look at the differences between FOMO and social anxiety. Before that, Jamiroquai plays next on UK Health Radio.
Hi, I'm Hannah Shucksmith, and this is my mental health selfie for Mind. I have struggled with depression for quite some time, and most of it I've got through on my own. I am good at doing the right thing when I don't feel right. I'm good at taking the exercise I need. I'm good at responding to my body. I'm good at eating well. I'm fortunate that I've got great friends and I'm good at getting around them. But that wasn't enough. And I got to the point where I needed more help. And acknowledging that was really quite scary for me. So going to therapy felt okay because it was still me taking control, me having the initiative. It felt like I was doing everything in my power to make the situation better. But when therapy wasn't enough and I was still really struggling, I had to accept that I needed these antidepressants. It felt like a huge step to start taking them and a big taboo to say I needed something, a little tablet to make me feel okay every day. Why am I sharing this as my mental health selfie? Because I honestly believe it's these that have changed my life for the better. I've been on them since last May, so almost a year now. And okay, I have to swallow my pride every morning with the pill. But I feel good about being alive. I feel excited about waking up. I wake up and I look forward to the day If the sun's shining, I want to get outside. And that's not how I felt a year ago before I took the medication. If the sun was shining, it was like a painful sting on the fact that I was feeling so bad and yet the day was so beautiful. I wouldn't be here without these. And I'm sharing this because I know a lot of people feel like I did, that it's a big step to go onto antidepressants. And I want to really encourage you that if you've tried other things and you're not getting better, please do be kind to yourself. You don't have to be better on your own. You can be better with help. And some of that help looks like tablets. I had a skiing accident. I've just had an operation. I'm on crutches at the moment. I can only get around on crutches because my knee is in agony. And no one is looking at me thinking, gosh, she's using crutches. She's really failed at life. In the same way, no one is really making that judgment that I've failed because I'm on antidepressants, but I was making it of myself. But actually, I've succeeded because I've got over my pride and I am doing the thing that helps me. Now, if you've enjoyed this, please do your own mental health selfie for Mind and look up hashtag mental health selfie on YouTube to follow others.
You're listening to UK Health Radio. take you back to New Year's Eve for two reasons. One, I'd like you to think about how you were feeling that night. And two, to discuss the two extremes of the pressure. Let's start with your thoughts on New Year's Eve. If they were full of enthusiasm and positivity, I hope you've been able to can that enthusiasm and move forward with the same gusto. However, if they were negative, I'm wondering if you've had the opportunity to change these thoughts, even if it's little steps. Maybe this is something to think about in your own time. The pressure and build-up to New Year's Eve can be massive, and this can lead to a strange sense of apathy for the next few weeks, according to people who suffer from FOMO. FOMO, if you didn't know, is an acronym for fear of missing out. For those with FOMO, checking on social media all the time is the only thing that assures them they are not out of the loop. Findings show those with low levels of satisfaction of the fundamental needs for competence, autonomy, and relatedness tend towards higher levels of fear of missing out, as do those with lower levels of general mood and overall life satisfaction. But FOMO is a double-edged sword. On one side, you are compelled to go out and socialise. Yet on the other side, when you don't go out, constant social media checking is doing no more than fueling an already nervous burning fire. According to psychologists, the problem is FOMO sufferers look outward instead of looking inward. They become more tuned into thinking everything is better. The grass is almost greener, if you like. And by doing this, they are losing their authentic self. They become unrealistic as to what is relevant to them. Looking at social media isn't real life. It's a tableau of a small part of somebody else's life, which more often than not is staged to create a better image. Think of a selfie. Before taking it, you do your hair, your clothes. You make sure that people around you are looking equally as stunning as you. You may be outside the best nightclub when the picture was taken, but just metres from where you took the shot, a homeless person could be trying to get comfortable for the night. Two very different worlds, but only one is captured. And of course, for someone suffering from FOMO, the image and what they can see only exacerbates their frustration. Those caught up with FOMO don't recognise what is real and what is fake. Conversely, people who feel secure with their relationships don't need to be online, or post online regularly for that matter. So to recap the main points of FOMO. FOMO starts with sadness, and social media, as we know, makes it worse, not better. Facebook isn't morose, for example, but relying on it for happiness, well, that is. Happiness is about attention. Focus on the good, and you're going to feel good. Gratitude is essential. Imagine losing the things you're lucky to have, and then, once they're gone, you'll most certainly appreciate them. Social media isn't the devil, but we're wired to compare ourselves to others. And that doesn't provide a real perspective, particularly when everyone is cutting corners to look their best. And don't forget, when you are spending lots of time concentrating on what other people are doing, you're not actually enjoying your own time.
Fear of missing out, known as FOMO, is the worst. And I do speak from experience. I have what I jokingly refer to as summertime sadness right now. I often feel kind of sad and under pressure to always be enjoying myself. And if I'm not at the beach or at a party, I always think that everyone else is having all of the fun. The good news is that you can really learn to reduce your FOMO. When we concern ourselves with what other people are doing, where they're living, where they're working, where they're socializing, we miss out on the moment. And each moment we miss is time that we're losing from our own precious lives and our time on the planet. The fact that FOMO is such a popular expression highlights how much it really pervades our lives, and it's high time to put our energy to better use. Here are my top tips for overcoming the fear of missing out. Do something that you love. Fear of missing out is only possible when you're not where you want to be. If you're doing something that really matters to you, then you won't really think about other people and really concern yourselves with what they're up to.
You can use some downtime and meditate if you can to really allow what matters to you to surface and be guided from the inside. So listen to yourself and then get busy. Just don't believe the hype. Buddha said that comparison is a thief of joy, and the grass is always greener if we think about it that way. Instagram and Facebook certainly don't make this easier, as you often compare our behind-the-scenes lifestyle with other people's glamorous travel experiences and funny stories and party highlights. So put social media into perspective. No one is going to post their pajama pictures watching Silicon Valley eating takeaway pizza. Learn to really listen to yourself. I relax by reminding myself that my intuition is the best guide as to what's right for me. Don't torture yourself with thinking there might be a cute stranger or a potential networking contact at an event if your heart isn't going. You feel the way you do for a reason, so just trust how you feel. Be present. For a moment, just be still and breathe and notice your surroundings. So the sounds in the room, how your body feels, the light outside. Sometimes we don't pause and acknowledge the calmness of the present moments. When we're living in the now, we don't worry about the future or what other people are doing. We can be here and now fully, which can feel much better than we think. Yay! And finally, really use your FOMO to drive positive change in your life. Recurring fear of missing out and really focusing on what other people are doing might be a sign that there's something that really needs to change in your life. You can use this trigger to your advantage. It might tell you that you want to move to New York, to get out there and start dating, to start a blog, or maybe book a trip somewhere exciting. Maybe something is begging to be seized by you, and it's time for you to go and get it. You block the flow of opportunities into your life when you place attention on other people and what they're doing. And you can choose to use your energy wisely by focusing on your life and getting busy taking action.
From FOMO and worrying whether you are missing out, to not having the confidence to take part in the first place. This really is the other end of the spectrum. Social anxiety disorder, also called social phobia, is a long-lasting and overwhelming fear of social situations. It's a common problem that usually starts during teenage years, and for some people it gets better as they get older, although for many it doesn't go away on its own. It can be very distressing and have a big impact on your life, but there are ways to help you deal with it. Social anxiety is more than just shyness. It's an intense fear that doesn't go away and affects everyday activities. Self-confidence, relationships, work, and school life, for instance. Many people occasionally worry about social situations, but someone with social anxiety feels overly worried before, during, and after the situation. You might want to consider this. You may have social anxiety if you dread everyday situations, such as meeting strangers, starting conversations, speaking on the phone, working, and even shopping. You may be avoiding or worrying a lot about social activities, such as group conversations, eating with company, and going to parties. Do you always worry about doing something you think is embarrassing, such as blushing, sweating, or appearing incompetent? You may have social anxiety if you find it difficult to do things when others are watching you. You may feel like you're being watched and judged all the time. You may also fear criticism, avoid eye contact, or have low self-esteem. Often people with social anxiety have symptoms such as feeling sick, sweating, trembling, or a pounding heartbeat. Social anxiety can be as simple as just having a panic attack. Many other people with social anxiety also have other mental health issues, such as depression, generalized anxiety disorder, or body dysmorphic disorder. And if any of these points ring true for you, then it's possibly time to get help. It's a good idea to see your GP if you think you have social anxiety, especially if it's having a big impact on your life. You'll be pleased to know it is actually a common problem and there are treatments available to help you. But here's the rub. Asking for help can be difficult, but your GP will know this and will try to put you at ease. Your GP is going to ask you about your feelings, your behaviours and your symptoms to find out about how your anxiety works in social situations. If they think that you could have social anxiety, you will be referred to a mental health specialist to have a full assessment and talk through all the possible treatments. But there are ways you can overcome and improve your social anxiety. We know it can be difficult to deal with, but there are things you can try for yourself, as well as several effective treatments and support groups that may be able to help you. Self-help probably won't cure your social anxiety, but it may reduce it, and you might find it a useful first step before trying other treatments. So try to understand more about your anxiety. Think about what goes through your mind, how you behave in certain social situations, to help you get a clearer idea of the problems you want to tackle. Replace your unrealistic beliefs with more rational ones. For example, if you feel a social situation went badly, think if there are any facts to support this, or if you are just assuming the worst. Don't think too much about how others see you. Pay attention to other people instead, and remember that your anxiety symptoms aren't as obvious as you might think. Start to do activities that you would normally avoid. And this is going to be tough at first, so start with small steps and work towards, well, the more feared activities gradually. There are a number of treatments also available for social anxiety, and the main options are CBT with a therapist. And this therapy will help you identify negative thought patterns and behaviours and what to do to change them. CBT is generally considered the best treatment, but other treatments may help if it doesn't work or you don't want to try it. Some people need to try a combination of treatments, and this might include psychotherapy. Therapy that involves talking about how your past influences what happens in the present and the choices you make. The good news is there's plenty of support groups available. There are several charities, support groups and online forums, specifically with people with social anxiety. And these include Anxiety UK, Health Unlocked, an anxiety forum run by Anxiety Support. You'd also have a look at Mind and Young Minds, Social Anxiety UK, who also have an online forum, the Anxiety Alliance, and finally Triumph Over Phobia. Still to come on the therapy suite, information on a mental health subject, which could be a little scary and maybe quite misunderstood. So stay tuned for that.
You send me someone who really loves me.
Before we move on, if you have a mental health story to tell, whether it's your journey or someone close to you, or you run a mental health project, do get in touch with me, either on Twitter, @Duncan_Ellison, or email duncan@thinkduncan.com. This is UK Health Radio. Hello, my name's Duncan, and I'll be with you each week to put a new twist on mental health. If you like this show and want more, you can listen to all the different programmes UK Health Radio has to offer. You can choose the live play schedule or download your favourite programme on demand wherever and whenever you need to. In this week's Toolbox Talk, I want to approach a subject which is rarely discussed. And I think this is for several reasons, not least because it's misunderstood, and because of that it's still a taboo subject. So this week I want to look into sectioning.
A guide to what it means to be sectioned and what your rights are. There are lots of different types of section. Each are used for different situations. They are normally referred to by their numbers, but essentially, if you are sectioned or put on section, you are kept in hospital and can be given treatment without your agreement. Taking away someone's rights like this should never be done lightly. That's why there is a law called the Mental Health Act, which sets out strict rules to make sure that it is only done if completely necessary. It is the different parts of this law, or the sections, that the term sectioning comes from. There is also a code which tells professionals how they should protect you and your rights when you're being considered for and while you are under section. When you have a mental health problem, being sectioned might be one of the scariest things to think about. That's because being kept in hospital against your will is scary and can feel more like a punishment than a way of treating a mental health problem. It is important to remember, though, that sectioning should always be the last resort. For example, if you're worried about going to your GP about having a low mood, it is very unlikely this will lead to being sectioned. Your GP will offer things like medication, talking treatments, or community support services, which you can use whilst carrying on with your normal life. To be sectioned, someone such as your GP, psychiatrist, or a member of your family must let your local social services or community mental health team know they are worried about you. They will only arrange an assessment to decide if you need to be sectioned if you need to be assessed and treated for your mental health problem urgently. Your health could be at serious risk of getting worse if you do not get treatment quickly. Your safety, or someone else's safety, is at serious risk. Or your doctor thinks you need to be assessed and treated in hospital. For most types of section, there has to be three people, including a medical practitioner, a Section 12 approved doctor, usually a psychiatrist, and an approved mental health professional present. They must consider whether there is any other way of getting you the treatment you need. Only if there is not, should you be sectioned. During this assessment, you have a right to ask questions and express your views. Or if this is something you find difficult, you can also ask for a friend, a family member, or a professional advocate to help you, although this might not always be possible. If the assessors decide that you need to be sectioned, then they need to make sure that the hospital is suitable and that there is a hospital bed available for you. How long you have to stay in hospital will depend on which section you are under. You're entitled to written information on this once you are on the ward. Even though you may not be able to leave the hospital or make decisions about your care, you don't lose all your rights. You are still entitled to copies of your sectioning paperwork, telephone access, and an independent mental health advocate to help you express your views. You also have a right to complain about your care or to appeal your section and get in touch with your solicitor. These are the rights that you should have. Unfortunately, mind hears from lots of people who aren't treated in this way. If you think your rights have been breached, or want to talk to someone about making a complaint, our info line can help. You can also find out more about sectioning on the Mind website.
There's plenty of information online about sectioning, although it can make for complicated reading, as you can imagine. So if you do want more information, a good place to start is the Mind website, where you'll find information which is, well, less complex. So head over to www.mind.org.uk. We're coming up to the end of the programme now. I hope you've enjoyed what's been quite a deep programme this week. let's finish with wise words. Very short and sweet this week. See what you think to this. Make your life a masterpiece. You only get one canvas. Don't forget, if you do have any mental health concerns or have been affected by anything raised on today's programme, please consult your GP or find a counselling service to talk to. Thanks for your company. You've been listening to The Therapy Suite with me, Duncan Ellison, only on UK Health Radio. Stay well, keep smiling, see you next week.